The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Thank you. It's wonderful to be back at the Free Library, and I'm honored to be reading tonight with the other esteemed guests. And I'm also relieved for two reasons, because last week we had I had a reading with Zeke Smeda at the 92nd Street Y in New York, and then today someone sent me a link with some high school kids who this was their first reading, and then they couldn't, most of their description was how they couldn't stay awake. So it's good to at least share that burden tonight with two more people. This book is about a triad of events that happened to me between the summer of 2004 and the spring of 2005, in which I found out that my father was dying with pulmonary fibrosis, and that I was pregnant with my daughter. And a few months later, my uncle Joseph, who had raised me in Haiti when my father moved to the United States, had died in the custody of U.S. Homeland Security. So the book is about these three events. So I tend to I think of it, and I see it as less of a memoir, you know, in the sense of me, but I call it a noumoir, more like an usmoir, because it's really, I feel like it was written by the three of us, really, by myself, my father, and my uncle. And I've written essays in the past, and I'd written some op-eds on this issue, especially this issue with immigration. But I never thought that I would write a memoir, because I felt in some ways that I was using that material to write my fiction, and I didn't want to, you know, just birth it all at once, if you will. And I also feared the indulgence of it. But when these things were happening, and I think if you're, you know, I'm a writer, and that's how I process material. And I just, I started jotting some things down, and they all came together in that way. And then one day I was in a bookstore, and I was looking at everybody's different books where people talked about, you know, their fathers and loved ones, especially loved ones that have lost. And I came across a book by Paul Auster called The Invention of Solitude, where there was this line in it where he starts with, to begin with death, to work your way back into life, and then to return to death. And that the last sentence was the vanity of trying to say anything about anyone. And in that sentence, really, I almost found like the purpose of what I was trying to do. So this book became a kind of personal exploration and a way of understanding and making some deeper connections with things in my family, but it was also a sort of documentation of what had happened, especially with my uncle. We had, for example, to get a lot of the papers, a lot of the what happened in the last days, I got from documents that we had to acquire through the Freedom of Information Act, and then had to reconstruct and retell. But these documents ultimately, I felt, dealt with his death, which then called forward which begged to the question of asking what his life was about. But tonight I'll just read two very short sections, and one is a chapter called Transition, and it has just the beginning of the chapter, which talks about two kinds of transition. And one thing, when my father was dying, the thing that we talked about, a lot of things, and I do feel like when he died that we didn't leave very much unsaid, but a lot of the things that we talked about a lot, that he wanted to see my daughter born, and so that part of the that Ari talks a little bit about those two transitions. And then at the end, I'll close with a folktale that we were told growing up about dying, because also when you're going through these situations, you start thinking, you really reach for everything you know. And one of the things that I kept going back to were these stories that I was told when I was young about death, following, you know, in the African tradition, and that if someone, when you name people after they're gone, that means they always remain with you. So this transition. There's a stage in labor called transition, when the baby, preparing to separate from the mother, twists and turns to pass through the birth canal. I am sure there's a similar stage for exiting life, though it might be less definitive. Still, as I go into to labor, each time I wish for an easy transition for my daughter and myself, I wish the same for my father. Our midwife, Colleen, encouraged me to add some personal touches to the lavender labor room at the birthing center, so I brought two old photos of my mother and father. In his picture, my father is handsome, serious-looking, and 26 years old. He's wearing a pale jacket, a high-collared shirt, a pencil-thin tie, and glasses. My mother in hers is wearing a blouse with a giant button on the front. Her hair is straightened in a round face framed by small drop earrings. When the midwife sees my mother's picture, she thinks that my mother is me. I looked at my parents' sepia-toned faces intermittently during the 16 hours that I walked, lay down, sat in a tub, on a ball, on the toilet, in constant agony. How could my mother have done this four times, I wondered. My mother once briefly told me the story of my birth. I was newly born in a pebble courtyard outside the maternity ward of Port-au-Prince General Hospital. My father was out of the city for his work, and my mother, fiercely independent, proud and alone, was one of nearly a dozen women who were doubled over and wailing in the yard. There were too many of them and not enough doctors. No one even examined them until their babies crowned. During her 4 hours of active labor, my mother tried very hard not to wish death upon herself. She staggered in and out of consciousness until a doctor finally surfaced and rushed her into the delivery room. When my daughter was born, her face blood-tinted, her eyelids swollen with tiny light pink patches that the midwife called angel's kisses. Her body coiled around itself as if to echo the tightness of her tiny fist. I instantly saw it as one of many separations to come. She was leaving my body and going into the world, where she would spend the rest of her life moving away from me. Groggy and exhausted, I asked the midwife, "Is it normal for me to think this? Maybe you're one of those women who enjoys being pregnant," she said. It wasn't so much that I enjoyed being pregnant. I simply liked the fact that for a while, my daughter and I had been inseparable. Looking at her tiny face, her bow-shaped lips, so red that her father said she looked like she was wearing lipstick, I remembered a message a girlfriend had sent me when my first niece and nephew were born. "May you be a reposoir," she had written, "a place where children can rest." I needed to rest myself, but I also wanted to speak to my daughter, cradle her, sing to her, inhale her mist blood and soap smell, watch her ever so slightly open her eyes and tighten her mouth as she tried to make sense of all the new sounds around her, my husband's laughter, my mother-in-law's comparisons with relatives both living and gone. I thought she most resembled my mother and pointed at the picture at my bedside to prove it. But I also saw traces of my father, who my mother says was too frightened to hold me and my brothers when we were babies, but who would rather hold my brother's children now, would laugh and sing to them. I grieved for my Uncle Joseph, who would never hold my daughter, and for my Haitian cousins, who might never know her. Or maybe she would return home one day to declare in heavily accented Creole that they were her family. She might be honored by their nods of acknowledgement, the way they'd be forced to consent. Of course, I see the resemblance. You do look like your great-grandmothers around the cheeks. You do have the high foreheads of your grandfather's kin. and hopefully those cheeks and that calabash-shaped forehead would gain her entry. Looking into my daughter's eyes, I thought of my mother who had faced these first hours alone after I was born. She had been made no promises, been offered no guarantees that either she or I would even live past the night. If something had been ruptured inside of her, no one would have noticed. If something had been broken inside of me, perhaps no one but her would have cared. My daughter's quiet yet well-monitored first night was perhaps the one my mother had dreamed for me, for herself, a dream of kind words, flowers, kisses. "What have you decided to call her?" asked the midwife. My husband and I had discussed it. There seemed to be no other possible choice. "Mira," I said, "for my father." After patiently waiting his turn to hold her, my husband held out his hand. I was also reluctant to let my daughter go. "Hopefully I'll have an uninterrupted lifetime with her," I thought. "A lifetime to plant some things that have been uprooted in me and uproot others that have been planted." But surrender her I did, with an urgent wish to also hand her over to my father. "Look, Papa," I would say, "you've waited to meet her, and here she is. You've lived long enough to see her. Today is not just her day, but all of ours. And we're not the only ones who will cradle and protect her. She will also hold and comfort us. She too will be our reposoir, our sacred place to rest." Yeah. This is a very short section. It is it's a folk tale about death, and the moral of it is that we should not allow grief to silence us. Grandma Melina once told a story about a daughter whose father had died. The daughter loved her father so much that her heart was shattered into 100 pieces. When it came time to plan for the jubilant country wake, which was once held the night before all funerals, the daughter wanted no part of it and ordered that it not be held. "Daughter," said one of the wise old women in the daughter's village, "let the people rejoice at your father's wake tonight before they cry at his funeral tomorrow." "There will be no rejoicing," answered the daughter. "Why should I ever rejoice again when my father is dead?" "Daughter," insisted the old woman, "let the wake be held. Your father is now in a land beneath the waters. It is not our way to let our grief silence us." Knowing that the old woman had the gift that the ancestors granted to only a chosen few of being able to journey between the living and the dead, the daughter said to the old woman, "I will allow the wake to be held only if you go to the land beneath the waters and bring my father back." The old woman walked to the nearest river and slipped into the waters. A few hours later, she reemerged and walked straight to the daughter's house. "Where's my father?" asked the daughter. "Daughter," said the old woman, "I am back from beneath the waters, deep into the bowels of the earth. There were some wide and narrow roads, and I took them. There were many hills and mountains, and I climbed them. There were hamlets and villages, towns and cities, and I passed through them too. And finally I reached the land of the ancestors, the city of the dead." "Did you see my father?" asked the daughter impatiently. "I saw so many people there, I couldn't even tell you," answered the old woman. "I saw my mother and father. All my loved ones who have died were there too." "Did you see my father?" shouted the daughter. "Daughter," answered the old woman, "I looked and I looked amongst all of those people until I found your father." "Where is he?" asked the daughter. "I've come to take you back to the land of the living," I told your father. "Your daughter's heart has been broken into 100 pieces, and she cannot live without you." "What did he say to that?" asked the daughter. "I am so touched that my daughter wants me to come back," he said. "But my home is now here in the land of the dead. Tell my daughter for me that when one is alive, but when one is dead, one is dead." The old woman then pulled from her pocket a set of false teeth that the father had religiously worn in his mouth when he was still among the living and had taken with him into the land of the dead. Your father sent you this, said the old woman, so that you might believe that I saw and accept what he says. The daughter took the false teeth in her hands and looked at them with great sadness, but also with a new sense of courage. As my father wishes, so it shall be, she said. We will have the wake and honor him, to rejoice, to celebrate his life before his body is put in the ground. We will eat, we will sing, we will dance and tell stories, but most importantly, we will speak of my father's, for it is not our way to let our grief silence us. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to read from Sion. Sion is my seventh novel, but it is the first one to be set in the United States. All of my other novels are set in South Africa, which is where I come from. Now, I never thought I would one day write a novel set in America until I discovered a very interesting community in the southeast of Ohio, deep in the Wayne Forest, where the Wayne people, as they are called by others, live. They are called the Win people, Win, W-I-N, which stands for White Indian Negro, because they are, in fact, I would call them an ethnic group that emerged in the 1830s, 1840s, from the intermarriages of the Native Americans who were the original owners of that area and the African slaves who were escaping from the South across the Ohio River on their way to Canada. Many of them ended in that village. The village is called Kilvet. That's the name of the village. And then, of course, we had the Irish mostly, and some Germans, but mostly Irish, many of whom were indentured laborers, who also found refuge in Kilvet. And the three groups then intermarried, and from that we had this new ethnic group with a very fascinating syncretic culture, you know, that draws from the three mother cultures. Now, they lived there in isolation, being marginalized by the rest of the population. In sociology, they are referred to as the triracial isolates. Now, what fascinated me about the Win people, well, besides the fact that, you know, they are very proud of their heritage, they believe that one day the whole world will look like them, you know. They say, well, white people will be bred out, black people will be bred out as well, and then everybody will look like them. But also, they are very proud of, you know, their heritage, and one of which is a quilting tradition. The women there make quilts, you know, wonderful quilts. But, you know, traditional quilts, they are very strict about keeping to traditional patterns and designs. You know, so these are not the art quilts that you find mostly in galleries and so on. These are traditional quilts because they are very strict on that. They believed that their ancestors used these quilts to escape from the South. they claim that these quilts, you know, these quilts carried messages, you know, the designs themselves and the patterns and so on and the colors carried codes, and they told me about these codes that, you know, the escape, the fugitives could use to find their way until they got to Kilvet. Now, we know, of course, that historians have, or some historians have disputed that, because they say, well, there's no historical record that the slaves ever used quilts, you know, in that manner. But to me, that's not important. What is important is that the Win people, and by the way, they don't call themselves Win. They are called the Win people by others. When you ask them, well, what do you call yourself? They say, we don't belong to nobody. Now, so I'll say the so-called Win people then. You see, what matters to me is that the so-called Win people believe that their ancestors used quilts in that manner. And therefore, their ancestors used quilts in that manner. Irrespective of what historians say. Why? Because, you see, we all and always create our own past. We create our past as we go along, in fact. And once in a while, we stand and look back and transform that past to suit our present. You know, sometimes, you know, to validate our present, and in some cases, even to palliate our present. So, in my novel, then, I do not say that the Win people believed that quilts were used in this manner. They are actually used in that manner. And then I found that they also have quilts there, you know, that they inherited from their great-great-grandmothers, you know, pre-Civil War quilts, you know, that they are still keeping. Because, you see, these quilts, actually, the very spirits of the people who lived, you know, are embedded in these quilts. You understand that, you know, when we talk of the bedding of the quilts inside there, you know, in order to make a quilt like a comforter, were made from the old dresses that these people used to wear, you know. But also, the quilt themselves, you see, a whole life was enacted on the quilts. You know, a whole cycle of life was enacted on these quilts. People were made on those quilts. People were born on those quilts. People got sick on those quilts. And people died on those quilts. So you find that each quilt has a narrative of love and loss. So I'm going to read here. So you see, you find that in my novel, I shuttle between the past and the present, using these quilts as a portal that takes us to the past. So I'll just read a brief section here from the past and then another brief section from the present. And by the past here, I'm talking of the 1830s, 1840s, because in the novel, I trace the ancestors, you know, the African line of the ancestry of these so-called Win people. I also trace right from Ireland the Irish line of the Win people and of course the original, you know, Native American line, which was there, you know, for all times in that region. That night it snowed quite seriously, and the Abyssinian queen sat on a stool in her cabin waiting for the boys. The sewing matriarchs, now blind with age, had long gone to bed. But she would not sleep before she allocated the boys' dreams for the night. It had been her practice, since they were little, to give each one a dream to dream every night before she herself sank into a dreamless sleep. So it was that she waited and waited and waited. About midnight, she began to suspect that something was wrong. The boys never stayed out that late. When they had plans to sneak away and visit friends or to play outside in the moonlight, they always came to the house, first for the evening meal and then for the allocation of dreams, because they knew that their mother liked to sleep early. She worried that something had happened to them, but she never suspected that they had carried out a daring escape. They would have said goodbye to her before the flight, wouldn't they? They would not be so foolish as to escape in the middle of such a vicious cold winter. Dreading that she would find what she would find, or perhaps not find, she went out and searched the hollow of the ghost tree. The quilt bundles were gone. The boys would not be coming back. Something must have happened to hasten their escape, and they obviously did not confide in her because they knew that she would persuade them to postpone the flight for a better season. She wept softly and prayed for their safety. It was the season that worried her more than the escape itself. She feared the boys would not get too far. They would be forced back by the weather or by the slave chasers. It was indeed difficult, even for the Sciolist, to come to terms with a winter escape. For instance, what would the boys eat when the dried fruit ran out? If the Sciolist had made the boys escape in summer, or at least in fall, they would trap all sorts of wildlife that was plentiful in the region. They would also eat the cherries and blackberries that grew wild on the mountainside and were ripe in the late summer and early fall. In the late fall, deer breed and become stupid. They fall prey to mediocre hunters. The boys would feast on venison. They would survive on the acorns from the red oaks and the pecan-tasting nuts from the giant hickory trees, all of which were good to eat for both squirrels and humans. They would even devour the squirrels themselves. But in winter, what is there to eat? This was not the boys' immediate concern as they trudged in the deep snow with the Sciolist as the spirit that must guide them to safety now that he has acquiesced to a winter escape. Their steps were slow and labored because of the bundles they carried, and the oversized boots and three pairs of old stockings each boy wore, and the rags they'd wrapped on their hands and around their legs under their breeches, and the balaclava-like hats crocheted by their mother the previous summer, and the women's corduroy coats they wore, handed down to their mother by the lady of the house years ago, when the Abyssinian queen was still a much-favored occupant of the big house. At first, the boys walked in a southerly direction, for they had no knowledge of the world beyond the plantation. The map that their mother had stitched on Abednego's quilt was not helping that much, since its cardinal points were rather confusing. Nicodemus had the feeling that they had misread the map, and they argued about it. After failing to come to any agreement, they decided that the map would not be of any use to them. The quilt would only be good for keeping them warm and also as a keepsake in memory of their mother, not only because it was a gift from her, lovingly made especially for this occasion, but it also retained a peculiar life-affirming scent, even though it had spent months in the heart of a ghost tree. The sampler, too, it continued to exude her odor, despite the fact that not so long ago she had washed it with lye soap after it had become dirty from staying in the heart of the ghost tree for too long. It was like their mother was with them throughout the journey. They walked in the night with the snow piling to cover their tracks after them. Now, that's all I'll read so far in as far as that section from the past. I'll read another brief section from the present day, because, like I say, in the novel, you know, the novel is about the present day people, the present day people as, you know, but then from time to time we shuttle to the past to look at their ancestors and how that heritage informs their present. Now, here is a family in Kilvert in 2004, just after the elections. And the matriarch, Ruth, the matriarch here, who is a staunch, you know, well, a wonderful quilt maker and a staunch Ohio Republican. And her reason, of course, is that because the GOP freed them slaves. As usual, Opa is not at the dinner table. And I've not heard her music today. Somehow I miss it. The silence leaves a hole in me. Don't ask me why. I'm sitting with Ruth, Obert, and Marlon Quigley, yet all of a sudden I feel lonely, as if someone very important in my life has suddenly taken leave of me. Today's specialty is hot dogs with carrot and cilantro relish. The carrots and the cilantro are from Ruth's backyard garden. She leaves the carrots in the garden, waiting for the ground to get cold, because the colder the ground, the sweeter the carrot. In the morning, when we were leaving for Athens, I saw her digging them out, and now she has made the sweetest of relishes from them. The cilantro, on the other hand, went to seed in the summer, and she says she picked it quite early in the fall in order to keep it fresh. She laments that she has to buy tomatoes because she no longer has them in her garden. It is against her principles to buy tomatoes or any kind of vegetable because her people have always raised their own food. Did I know that her people, them Indian people, that is, gave the world tomatoes and corn and potatoes? I congratulate her for it. And she turns to Obert and orders, "Take some hot dogs to your sister." "It won't help, Ma," says Obert gleefully, as she takes two buns and puts hot dogs in each of them. "Maybe you should tell her you are sorry." "I ain't sorry for nothing," says Ruth adamantly. Obert takes the hot dogs, ketchup, mustard, and relish to Opa's room. I don't know why today Ruth is concerned that Opa should eat. Usually, when she has not turned up for dinner, she only exclaims that the girl will blow away. And then we continue our meal, as if nothing has happened. For some reason, today she sends Obert to take her food to her room as if it is some peace offering. Ruth wants to hear about my day in Athens. Did I manage to fix my papers? I avoid answering that particular question, because I don't want to lie to her. As it is, I'm burdened enough already trying to keep Obert's secret from her, both his misadventure at the sorority house and the mediation. I find the load too heavy to bear and I'm unhappy with myself for promising him after he begged me again and again on our way back from the mediation that I would keep the secret. Instead, I tell her about the sad demonstration we saw on Court Street. Now you're gonna get her started, says Obed, dreading another one of his mother's political lectures. But there's no stopping Ruth when she's provoked into analyzing the ills of politicians. She believes that you cannot totally trust politicians because politicians crucified Jesus Christ. George W. Bush is an exception. He talks to God, and God talks to him, very much like the prophets of the Old Testament. As for Kerry, God would never have allowed him to ruin America, because America is a chosen nation. Did we know that Kerry asked the United Nations to rule America? She heard him with her own ears saying so on television. How can he ask other nations to rule America when America is a supernation? She asks in dismay. There is no end to Kerry's wickedness. He supports abortion, which is against the laws of God. He supports marriage between man and man and between woman and woman. Again, she heard Kerry with her own ears saying this. When Obed argues that Kerry never said such a thing, but has insisted that issues pertaining to marriage should be addressed by the states rather than through a constitutional amendment, and that Kerry himself believes in marriage between men and men, Ruth dismisses him as an ignoramus who never watches the news. It will be a disaster if anyone changes God's laws of marriage. Some men, and they are already doing it here in Kilvert, will have harems of women, make them all pregnant, and collect welfare. The taxpayer will be paying for all this, all because of the likes of Kerry. She pages through the Bible, which she keeps handy on a sideboard next to the dining room table. She reads from Leviticus, chapter 18, verse 22. You shall not lie with a man as with a woman. And to corroborate that point, she goes to a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to the Romans, verse 26. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use of what is against nature. Likewise, also men, leaving the natural use of the woman, bend in their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. She is about to read from another letter from the same Paul. The same Paul wrote to the Corinthians. But Obed has had enough. He declares that Paul was obsessed with homosexuality. He must have been a closet homosexual, as is the case with many homophobes. Ruth is scandalized by this blasphemy, especially because it is uttered in the presence of a visitor. Obed needs to pray to save his soul from eternal damnation. She feels very sorry for me after I make the mistake of telling her that in South Africa, gay rights are no longer an issue since they are protected by the Constitution. In that country, the courts have pronounced that the common law stipulation that marriage is between man and woman is unconstitutional, and have given the government 2 years for Parliament to amend the law to allow for gay marriages. Tudulu Your country is Sodom and Gomorrah, she proclaims. I'm glad you came to the good old U.S. of A. to escape the death and pestilence that the Lord is surely gonna visit on Africa. On South Africa, to be exact, I correct her, hoping that narrowing God's wrath to only one country will comfort her a bit. The rest of Africa doesn't have such laws. I think the rest of Africa would rather agree with you. But Ruth hasn't finished with John Kerry yet. He is a traitor, she says. He even speaks French. A fact he tried to hide, but that was exposed by the vigilant Fox News. He's so wishy-washy, he's likely to be a drinker of French wine. When all good people the world over are boycotting everything French. Didn't we all see him on television? He looked ridiculous, creeping around in the wilderness, shooting geese, in order to prove that he was not a liberal. She breaks out laughing at the strange image of a camouflaged and gun-toting Mr. Kerry, bumbling in the woods, which obviously is still quite vivid in her mind. I can see what Ruth is talking about. The man tried to play to a jingoistic gallery, but it did not applaud. It knew he was a fake. He only wanted to win their favor, and as soon as he got it, he would surely lead the country down a ruinous path of personal freedoms. No one interrupts Ruth when she is on her political platform, except an occasional snide remark from Obed, who obviously does not share his mama's politics, but would rather not prolong the agony of sitting through another harangue by debating with her. Marlon Quigley, on the other hand, just sits there and smiles. I have caught Ruth stealing a glance at him and breaking into a soft smile of her own, even in the middle of her fulminations against Kerry. He returns a sly look, and the smile on his lips creeps to his eyes. It is obvious to me that the two are still very much in love. Well, that's as far as I'll go. Thank you. Thank you.
There hasn't been a time in the past few years when I've gone up and down stairs that I haven't feared that I'd fall on my face. I'll read from the first few pages of a story titled The Devil Swims Across the Anacostia River. Some 14 years after her grandmother walked out into the Atlantic Ocean on her way to heaven, Laverne Shepherd went into the Safeway on Good Hope Road Southeast and for the first time came face to face with the devil. That morning in the store, she had, like so many times before, taken a shopping cart from just inside the door and maneuvered it to the aisle farthest to the left. She neared a face-high display of canned pinto beans and glanced at a short shopping list after she took it from her sweater pocket. And when she looked up from the list of four or so items, the devil was before her. She stopped, not out of fear, but because to go any farther would have meant running into him with the cart. Himself been studying you, the devil said. Laverne looked down at her wedding ring on the hand, resting on the cart's handle, and when she raised her eyes, the devil was taking off his hat in that dramatic way men did in old movies to impress women who needed very little impressing. The devil was dressed in a splendid gray gabardine suit, and down through the metal rods of the empty cart, Laverne could see that on feet small enough to belong to a little girl, he wore two-tone black and white shoes. The knot of his purple tie was situated just so to the left of his Adam's apple, as if he had dressed himself without the benefit of a mirror. There was an almost boyish quality to the off-center knot, and for a moment Laverne thought it would have been the most natural thing in the world for a woman, any woman, to reach over and center the knot, and then the whole gesture would final tap the finger on the knot. There, that'll do you for a while. The tie was held in place against his white shirt with a ruby tie clip about the size of a candy fireball. Himself been studying you, the devil said again, now smiling. All the teeth in his head were perfect, exquisite white marvels that were an artwork all their own. A woman could spend all day and part of the next just laying about looking at them. Turn a little bit and let me see how the light shine on them that way. Both her grandmothers had come to know the devil so well that he, in all his guises, called them always by their childhood nicknames. At various times in her life, Laverne's grandmothers had tried to tell her how she would know the devil that first time. It will be that explained as best they could the way you know that you're hungry or that you're thirsty. The body will say it, and you will take it as gospel. But they had not told her what to say, what to do, whether to run or go forward and attack him with the fury of an angel doing God's work. Once more the devil said, himself, been studying you. He came toward her, and as he did, he lowered the arm with the hat down to his side. The fedora was the same pleasing gray as his gabardine suit. The devil himself was the color of an everyday brown paper bag. He rested a hand on the side of the cart, less than a foot from where a redding hand was resting, and turned down his smile a few degrees, turned it down in disappointment, as if he had come upon a long-lost friend, and the friend had denied knowing him. What? Laverne said. What? She was 9 weeks pregnant with her second child, happy in all things, happy in her 25th year of life. The devil said, himself come all this way, come all the way across the river, swim all the way across at Anacostia, himself swim all the way to say good morning and say how you do. She was still not afraid, but looked about, mostly with a strange wonder that they were at last together, and together in such an odd and bright place of food and people and things to clean the kitchen floor with. The sign on the display of canned pinto beans said 8 for $1. It occurred to Laverne that that might be a particularly good price, but she could not remember if her husband or son liked pinto beans. It was when she looked back at the devil that the smell of him came drifting her way, a non-threatening fragrance that didn't mind taking all the time it needed to get to her. It was a wonderful, though subtle, cologne that for Laverne simply said, everything good about men. Himself been studying you, the devil said, quietly now, as if he were sharing the great secret of her life. Laverne stepped away from the devil in the cart and walked uneasily out of the Safeway. She made her way a block and a half up Good Hope Road, and on a bench in front of Cleopatra's Hair Emporium, she sat, the crumpled shopping list in her left hand, resting on the green bench. She was back in the world, back in life, and was so glad that she felt like reaching out and touching a body or two passing by Cleopatra's Hair Emporium. Two women went into Cleopatra's, and one of the women was saying she really wanted some bangs, but her companion told her bangs would make her face look fat. But I really want them bangs, the first woman insisted before they closed the door to the emporium. Laverne crossed her legs and with the tips of her fingers rearranged her skirt down over her legs. Himself been studying you. For the third time that morning, she wished she had not stopped smoking. She considered calling her mother, her mother's wealthy mother, who had known the devil mostly in his guise of an old woman for nearly 60 years. She turned her head and looked into the window of the beauty parlor. The woman who wanted the bangs was being seated in a chair 2 seats from the window. In the chair at the window was an old woman who was getting her black hair unfurled from light blue curlers. Standing beside the woman was a little girl who could have been the woman's granddaughter. The girl's hair was done up quite nicely, and she seemed to be watching the old woman in her hair as if to make certain that the same care was given to her grandmother. The woman who wanted the bangs was talking a mile a minute to Cleopatra, who waded through the woman's hair with her fingers in preparation for the job ahead. Laverne Head, after the birth of a son, tried to do good, to put off as long as possible this day, the day of meeting the devil, sending money to the Salvation Army, going to church every week until all that singing and preaching began to depress her, trying to banish impure thoughts. But all that good had not put off this day. She had paid little attention to the story that the devil had a special thing for the women on both sides of her family, a thing born with Eve. It was said that all the women in her family had the answer to a riddle that would make the devil the king of heaven. All he had to do was pose the riddle in the right way to the right woman, alive or dead, and the answer would send God tumbling from his throne and down to the narrow perch the devil had been consigned to for all history. Now, the devil had knocked at her door. Laverne looked at the shopping list and then put it back in a sweater pocket and patted the pocket. A car going up Good Hope Road tooted its horn at her, but she did not hear it. After several minutes, she closed her eyes and took herself down Good Hope Road, across the bridge, and out through Washington, through Maryland, until she was on the August Beach 14 years ago, the Atlantic Ocean only a few yards away, and the heat waves swimming all along the dull blue horizon, one seagull conversing with another. She was wearing her cousin's bathing suit and sitting on the beach with her feet dug into the sand, snuggled close to her paternal grandmother, who was in her after-church, all-day Sunday dress. And on the other side of the grandmother were Laverne's brothers, boys of 8 and 5 years. Laverne's father and mother had gone to a refreshment stand near the parking lot to buy snacks. The beach was full of colored people. What her grandmother heard before she was compelled to stand up, Laverne never knew, but once her grandmother did stand up, the voice was clear for all the Negroes along the beach to hear. Only her grandmother, after putting on her shoes, moved toward the water and the voice, and, as if there were a silent command, those Negroes who had been swimming came out of the water and looked at the horizon from where the voice was coming. There was a kind of roar that seemed to ascend from the ocean, another roar that seemed to descend from the sky. And there at eye level, the roars became words. The voice, emphatically clear and distinct, was not female, and it was not male. Laverne's grandmother hesitated, stopping a yard or more from the water, and the voice, without rebuke, asked the grandmother, "Did you come all this way to lose your faith, to drop down into the bottom of the sea? Ahead of you is this water, and behind you, he's coming. Did you lose your faith?" "No," her grandmother said. "No, I stand on my 2 feet." Before she set off again, she turned around and from her pocketbook pulled out 3 $10 bills. She gave one to each of her grandchildren, which was unusual for a woman who had never given them more than 50 cents at any one time, lest they be corrupted. Laverne's youngest brother, a boy of easy giggles, looked suspiciously at the $10 bill. He was still at an age where he did not trust paper money. It could tear, it could burn, it could fly away with the wind. But he folded the bill as small as he could and tucked it into the pocket of his swimming trunks. Laverne's grandmother set off again, and the youngest brother said, "Granny, you're going to ruin your pretty shoes in all that water." The grandmother looked down, somewhat worried, as if deciding between her $12.95 Holland shoes and the command of the voice of the universe. "We have waited since the first day," the voice said with the greatest patience. "Have you not waited since the first day? Have you not waited with us?" Their grandmother turned and looked at the boy, dark-skinned, bony, painfully perfect. He waved, though they were but a few yards apart. After several moments, the grandmother took a step and was standing where water met dry sand. She stopped, her brown patent leather pocketbook hanging from her left arm. Then, in a few more steps, she was standing a foot above the bottom of the sea. She continued walking, one uncertain step after another. All the Negroes along the beach were quiet, so that the loudest sound when the voice was silent was the ocean hitting the beach and then retreating. By now, Laverne's mother and father were back, followed by a lifeguard, who was looking about as if there was something that would make more sense than an old woman walking on water. Laverne's father watched until his mother was about 5 yards out on the water, and then he said, "Mama." Haltingly, Laverne's grandmother turned around for the first and only time. "Ian always told you it might come to this," she told her son. "I've done nothing that I couldn't clean up by the next day, and it was hard, but now I want to go and complain to somebody about it. Then shut up for good." Then she said to Laverne's mother, "Cheryl, you try to explain it to him, just to let him know. I got something I have to do right now." Laverne's father moved toward the ocean. He was crying but did not speak. He was drawn by his wife, and she was followed by the lifeguard. The children had not moved since their grandmother handed them the money. The grandmother set off again. With each step, all the Negroes on the beach could see that she was gaining confidence. Still, the lifeguard, when the grandmother was more than 20 yards out into the sea, shouted to her with complete sincerity, "Ma'am, you all right out there? You need some help?" Not stopping, the grandmother raised her right arm and wiggled her fingers that she was fine. For all the purpose and certainty of her step, she could have been walking down 7th Street on her way to St. Aloysius Catholic Church. There was nothing on the ocean and the horizon except the old woman, not a boat, not a buoy, and even the seagulls had disappeared from the air. When the grandmother was but a foot tall on the sea, her son sat down on the beach and refused to look any more. When the grandmother was an inch or so, Laverne walked to the ocean's edge and raised a hand to shade her eyes, and her youngest brother came up beside her and put his hand in hers. The other brother took a place beside his father. Then, in the time it took to sigh, the grandmother was gone completely. There was no more that day for anyone, even though the sun was way up in the sky. And little by little, the Negroes collected what they had brought to the beach and went back to their cars and buses. Now and again, a stranger would come up to Laverne or a member of her family. The strangers did not speak, but simply touched a shoulder or hand in sympathy and understanding. Laverne felt no sadness, and she slowly began to fear that she had loved her grandmother as much as the old woman had always said she loved her. The family's eyes stayed focused on the horizon, where the grandmother had disappeared, and Laverne and her family remained on the beach until well after the sun was down, accompanied only by the lifeguard, who had caught a chill, but who felt it was his duty to stay with them. Thank you.
Great readings. At this point, we'll have the Q&A, so if you have any questions, I would encourage you to raise your hand. Don't be shy, right there in the second row.
Respectfully acknowledging the gentleman, Sora Danticat, on behalf of Rho Theta Omega Chapter of our beloved sisterhood, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, I would like to present to you this bouquet of flowers. Thank you.
You can only ask a question if you have flowers. Next.
Thank you. I want to say thank you to my sorrow. Thank you.
Another question. Am I missing a hand? No? Well, it's been... Oh, gentleman right there with his hand up.
Thank you. Could I ask Edward Jones, does your fierce succinctness in your writing, is that something that came naturally for you, or do you have to work at it very hard?
No, it's in college there's a course, fierce writing, just writing till I just do it and I don't really give it in much thought. When When I've been teaching, I tried to tell students that the most important thing they can do is read, and read and read and read, and then start writing, because I think in reading you get a great sense, of course, of what is good and what's not good, and I suppose somewhere over all that reading, I developed a certain style, and that's it, and I can't really explain it beyond that.
Zaytsen and Dweej, can you speak to that? Do you have specific styles for specific books or characters of Oak styles, that something of that nature?
Well, I think that for me it really depends on the story that I'm telling, and the setting, and the point of view that I've adopted for that particular story. So it will change from novel to novel. Yes.
Is that the case with you, Edwidge? And was it different writing the memoir in that way?
Yeah, I think probably the story and everything that, you know, is part of your larger experience guides you. You know, like the story dictates, I think, how it wants to be written, and you kind of, usually you start with a thread and you follow that. You follow that thread, but not always consciously.
Yes.
Another question, right here in the third row.
Good evening. First and foremost, I would like to tell Medantika Oné.
Respect.
And besides Jacques-Stéphane Alexis, who else inspired you in your writings?
I there's so many. I think that I always said I consider myself more of a reader than a writer, you know, and it's inspiration is it's a funny thing. You're constantly inspired. I'm certainly inspired, for example, by the readings tonight, and I often have the experience of when I go to readings where I'm not reading, I always want to run home and write, and which is hard to do. Like tonight, if I had been in your place, I would try to go home and write. But I was Jacques-Stéphane Alexis, who you mentioned, is a great Haitian novelist who actually his novel Masters of the Dew was translated by Langston Hughes and Mercer Cook in the 30s. Certainly, you know, them and, of course, writers here like Toni Morrison and James Baldwin, Zora Neale Hurston, and Marie Chauvet, who is also our great Haitian female novelist who died in exile here. But it's constantly changing, because also we're part of the craft, I think, is also you're constantly reading and drawing inspiration both from life and from reading.
Right here in the corner.
First, I want to thank you for sharing. I really enjoyed all the readings themselves. And I was just wondering, what are your working habits or your writing habits? I know sometimes, you know, like if I'm writing, I don't care if it's a napkin or a piece of paper. If something hits me, I got to get it down. I've written in the back of books and so on. So I was just wondering, on an average day as you're creating, you know, what are some of the things that you do as far as keeping the flow going?
Is that to everyone? Anyone?
Okay, well, all right. I write, you know, I don't have any specific rhythm, you know. I write any time I feel like writing. But mostly daytime. I can't work at night. I write mostly early in the morning. But I am the kind of writer who does not need, you know, solitude to write. I write anyway. I, in fact, thrive very much in an environment where my kids are there, you know. and I'm playing with them, changing their diapers or cooking their food, and then writing at the same time. And you find that the more noise they make, they jump all over me and so on. That is even much more inspiring. And in many instances, some of the things they do or say find their way into my novels. You know, there's a lot that I can actually point out in all my novels that this was inspired by this child or that one when, you know, he or she did, you know, whatever. So, and ideas come, you know, they come at any odd moment. I always have bits and pieces of paper where I jot them down because I know that I'll forget it, you know, after a few minutes. When I get home, I transfer those onto a notebook. I keep a notebook. In fact, I keep notebooks for all the forthcoming novels, the novels that are still brewing in my head, you know. And on Christmas Day, I take stock of these novels, I mean, of the notebooks, and pick one that I think is ready to be written and start writing on that day. So all my novels are started on Christmas Day.
Well, I have to come over to his house and see how that's done with the children, because I have one child and I can't write while she's jumping around. I usually write at night. I sort of, it's something I'd gotten in the habit of. But if I'm working on something, I just try to write whenever I have free time. I don't have any rituals because I feel like if, you know, I don't want to not be able to write when those conditions don't exist. But I try to write whenever I can, but I prefer to write at night.
I don't have any sort of routine, so I'm boring in that way. What I do know is that you sort of spoke as if the physical writing is all there is. But if you spend 10 years with an idea and working it out in your head, then the work you do waiting for the subway or walking up and down supermarket aisle and working on the plot and the characters and everything, that also counts as writing. So I think you probably, and probably sometimes it even happens when you're asleep, because the mind is always working.
Another question, right on the aisle here, gentleman with his hand up.
Thank you, Free Library of Philly, for having this and the authors for coming. I wanted to ask each of you, what is your favorite work that you're reading right now, like within the past month, any work that you're enjoying right now?
I could start. I'm reading Chimamanda Ngozi's Half of a Yellow Sun, which I find very, very... I'm enjoying very much. I think it's extraordinarily powerful.
Well, I just finished reading Edwidge's actually earlier work, not this new one, the farming of the poems, and I'm now reading this Portuguese guy, Sarumanga, Blindness. That's what I'm currently reading.
Edward, you reading anything these days?
No, nothing beyond the newspapers.
Another question right here in the front.
This is a question to Professor Maida. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yeah, it's fine.
I thoroughly enjoyed Sion.
Thank you.
It was. I read it in 2 days, and I wanted to ask you: was Nicodemus real? Is his ghost real? Is there a place in Southeast Pennsylvania that is haunted by, or Southeast Ohio that is haunted by Nicodemus? But more importantly, I wanted to ask you: the writer Ngugi Wa Thiong'o talks about the importance of African writers writing in their traditional languages. And I wanted to know what your traditional language is, and if you, in fact, work in a traditional language vis-a-vis English. Thank you.
Okay. Well, your first question is on Nicodemus. You know, Athens, Ohio, that is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see, yeah, is reputed to be a haunted place. It is very famous for that. You know, I mean, ghost hunters come from all over, from Europe and so on, to look for ghosts there, and you know. The reason for that is that there used to be what they called then a mental hospital. Oh, no, they called it a mental asylum, sorry. At the Ridges, a place called the Ridges. And many of the patients died there and they were buried. So there are cemeteries all over the Ridge of these people, you see, who were buried there and who are reputed to be haunting the place. But Nicodemus is a specific ghost. He is not one of the ghosts from the Ridges, from the mental asylum. He is a ghost of, you see, Athens, Ohio was one of the routes or the trails of the Underground Railroad. So there were stations there. And Nicodemus died there. Nicodemus was actually a slave who had escaped from the south. And he was killed by slave chasers in one of the houses of the Underground Railroad stations. Now, he's reputed to be haunting that house. That house is still there. It is now a sorority.
Not my sorority.
And once in a while, Nicodemus, you know, comes up from the basement and touches the breasts of the girls. Well, at least that's what we are told. That's the story. So, that story then is part of the urban legend of Athens, Ohio. It only goes as far as that. But what I did in my novel, of course, I make him do what he does, you know, in the urban legend. He haunts the sorority. He plays around with a girl's breast. But then I also gave him a history. That part is fictional. You see? You know, I gave him a mother, you know, the Abyssinian queen, and a brother, Abednego, and made them, of course, escape from Virginia across Ohio until he's killed then at that house, which is now a sorority. So that's how then I link that. Now, about writing in what language and so on. I write in English now, you know. I also, well, I mean, and many of my books, of course, are also translated into the languages of South Africa, but mostly plays at this stage, not novels. You can read my plays in all the languages of South Africa, in fact. I don't write in those languages because those languages have much, much greater writers than I'll ever be in those languages. In South Africa, unlike in the rest of Africa, well, in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, and in Lesotho, we have a long tradition of literature written in the indigenous languages. So you find that we have writers who write in Xhosa, in Zulu, and so on, and we have had them for the last 200 years and so on. You know, we have had that literature in those languages. So we have those writers who write in those languages, and they are very good at that. I used to be good, too, when I was a little boy, because my first published work was in Xhosa. But then I was exiled. You know, as a teenager, my family went away from South Africa, and we were refugees for 30 years. So, of course, I lost the, you know, the literary kind of Xhosa and remained only with the conversational one. But English was a constant, so I continue to write in English. So now I just write in English. Although plays, sometimes I do create them in the other languages as well. Because plays being dialogue, you know, it's much easier to work that way.
Mm-hmm. A few more questions. Why don't we move toward the back? There's about nine rows back on your left, Christina, on your left. Okay, we'll take the child, and then we'll go nine rows back.
My name is Raheem Bird, and what inspired you to be a writer?
Is that for Edwige?
I think it's for everyone. Thank you for staying awake. The people who didn't stay awake were much older than you. So thank you for coming. What inspired me to be a writer? I always loved stories. I grew up in a family where people told a lot of stories, with my aunts and my grandmothers told stories, and I also loved books. From the time that I was very young, I loved to read. So I thought, oh, maybe I can try to do that, to try to also tell stories on my own way. But really, what made me want to be a writer was first listening to stories and then reading books.
Well, I can't say that I was ever really inspired. I think that the more education we get, the more things we experience, the more we begin to learn about what we can and cannot do. I can't be a book critic, so the next best thing is to be a book writer. but no, I think reading was probably the beginning of it. I heard a quote about a year or so ago that writers readers move to emulation. And so I read all those books, and one day I think it occurred to me that maybe, just maybe, I might want to do that. And when I was in college as well, I had courses in creative writing, fiction writing, story writing, and I was encouraged by the professors, and I think that was probably the beginning of it. But the greatest foundation for me was all the reading at libraries in Washington, D.C.
Zakes, do you want to respond to that? What inspired you?
Well, I was inspired by my grandmother. You know, she was a storyteller, as, you know, grandmothers tend to be in my culture, you know. Am I answering the right question?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. But also, I grew up, you know, from the time I was a little boy, I was surrounded by books. My father was a great reader. He was a lawyer by profession, but he was also an artist, a painter, and also a musical conductor, an orchestral conductor. So he was very steeped in the arts. So I grew up being inspired by his activities, but also his books. But then, of course, comic books. You know, I grew up reading comic books, which I still read up to this day. I'm a comic book reader, an ardent comic book reader. So I was inspired by my grandmother, by comic books, and the general reading that I, you know, storytelling. That I thought, well, maybe I could tell my own stories as well.
A few more questions. One, two, three, four rows back here. The lady with her hand up.
Good evening, and again, thank you to each of our authors this evening.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.